Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, the governor signs into law a bill guaranteeing access to reproductive health care. And two key senators weigh in on the pros and cons of a bill that will shape Minnesota's clean and renewable energy future. Stay tuned for this and more on this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Ensuring the right to reproductive health care, including abortion, was one of the issues that DFLers campaigned on. On Tuesday, Governor Walz signed into law House File 1, a bill that would establish a fundamental right to reproductive health care.
So to Minnesotans, know that your access to reproductive health and your right to make your own health care decisions are preserved and protected. And because of this law, that won't change with the political winds or the makeup of the Supreme Court.
This victory is for Indigenous women, for Native women, for Black women, for our LGBTQ plus neighbors and relatives, for low-income folks, for people who live in rural communities, and for everyone who has fought for sovereignty of their own bodies.
Fundamentally, this legislation is about who decides. Who should be legally entitled to make reproductive health care decisions for an individual?
We trust women. We trust patients, along with their licensed medical professionals, to make the right choice for themselves and their family when it comes to reproductive health care. Senate DFLers heard Minnesotans tell us over and over again they don't want their children to have less rights than they did for the last 50 years.
The Senate passed the measure on a vote of 34-33 following 15 hours of passionate debate.
We are not protecting the women or the girls or even the boys of Minnesota. It was previously mentioned that this is the darkest day that some have experienced in this body. Indeed, I think this is one of the darkest days we've experienced in the state of Minnesota.
This bill is sending a message to women that the best way out of a tough situation is through ending the life of their own child. Madam President, it is my sincere hope that the women of Minnesota know that I am speaking from experience today when I say they are stronger than they know. And I am sorry not one Democrat has stood up today and told them that.
We keep using the phrase guardrail, guardrail, guardrail. To me, this implies back to the old days where women were considered too emotional to make decisions or mentally feeble or whatever else, and somehow were this runaway car. The people in this position are the only ones that know all the factors in their life, in their health, in the health of the fetus, and everything else. They are the only person, along with the advice of their doctor, that has all the information. We will never have that, and to me, it's just extreme hubris that we would think that we can make that decision for other people.
When I heard some of the debates tonight, I found myself thinking, who is it that you don't trust? Is it women? Is it Minnesotans? Or is it doctors? Because there's obviously a very deep trust problem that some of the people in this chamber have with Minnesotans and with healthcare providers. Hearing some of these stories, you would think that it was going to be this murderous bedlam that was going to happen. Members, again, the PRO Act codifies into our state statute what is currently the law in the state of Minnesota.
The Senate is poised to pass updated energy standards, including a goal of 100% carbon-free electricity generation by the year 2040. Testifiers provided their feedback to the Senate Energy Committee.
The climate science demands this. The economy demands this. The opportunities demand this. In the last decade, the cost of solar energy and storage have declined by 85%. And the cost of wind energy has declined by 55%. Solar panels has actually declined 99.75% since I graduated from college some 45 years ago. 99.75% cost reduction.
Attempting to decarbonize Minnesota's electricity sector without building new nuclear power plants would cost our state an additional $313 billion through 2050, destroy more than 79,000 jobs, and could lead to devastating rolling blackouts.
We do have concerns with the legislation. It is prudent to exercise caution in imposing mandates. The pace of the generation fleet transition must be affordable for our customers in towns like Winger, and it must not jeopardize reliability.
Through continued collaboration and partnership alongside of our utilities, this will unleash significant job creation, spur business model innovation, and expand investment across our state. Second, this legislation strengthens Minnesota's energy independence and security.
Senator Nick Frentz, the chair of the Senate Energy, Utilities, Environment, and Climate Committee, and the author of Senate File 4, joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hey, Shannon. Nice to see you again.
Since 2007, the state has set energy benchmarks. Some, like the goal of 25% renewable energy by 2025, have already been achieved. The goal of Senate File 4 that everyone is talking about is the 100% carbon-free electricity production by 2040. Is it aspirational or, well, is it possible or is it simply aspirational?
It's possible, and it's something that I think in 2040 Minnesotans are going to be proud of. We've overcome a lot of challenges, not just in energy, but in industry. We fought two world wars. We've had a Great Depression. We overcame all of them, and we're going to meet this challenge. And I think we'll meet the 2040 goal of 100% carbon neutral as well, and I'm looking forward to it.
At a press conference prior to the House taking up the bill, which passed this bill on a party line vote, you said that the approach is agnostic when it comes to technology. What do you mean, and why is that approach the right way to go?
Well, first of all, it's the right way to go because it's the best way to achieve our goals. What the bill is trying to do is mitigate the effects of climate change, and the number one effect is carbon emissions going into the atmosphere. It's heating up the planet and producing all manner of things we don't want. Technology agnostic is a fancy way of saying the utilities must get to 100% by 2040, but they don't have to choose a certain energy mix. It doesn't have to be solar this percentage and wind this percentage. It doesn't have to be hydro during the summer. They can do it whatever way they want. And a key feature of the bill is respect for the utility boards. As you know, we have three types of utilities in Minnesota: investor-owned utilities, cooperatives, and municipal electrics. And all three levels are blessed with outstanding boards who are in the best position to choose which path they use, not only to protect reliability and price, but to go forward from there. Right now, Shannon, unsubsidized wind power is the cheapest, and the bill's going to help drive all utilities of every size to cheaper and just as reliable energy.
So we have a variety of utilities and how they operate, but it's up to them how to get to this 100% benchmark.
Exactly. And again, these boards are democratically elected. I'm a member of a rural electric co-op, Hey Benko, in North Mankato. I can tell you that board is educated, engaged, and they are responsive to their members. They're in a perfect position to judge this transition. And by the way, as you mentioned, they're already successfully navigating the 2007 benchmark. So I have a high degree of confidence in those boards to help.
Critics are saying that this bill may sharply increase energy costs, perhaps not equally across the state, but that smaller municipal and cooperative utilities may not be able to absorb the level of cost that the larger utilities can absorb. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, if we've increased costs for Minnesotans, then part of the bill has been a failure. Our goal is to reduce carbon and keep costs in control. So our plan is for small, medium, and large utilities to take advantage of these avenues. And you haven't asked about this, but the IIJA and the IRA, the federal bills, are sending money to our state to help with transmission, to help incentivize the transition to electric vehicles, a lot of stuff that small and large can take advantage of. Also, these utilities have my pledge and the pledge of a lot of other legislators to continue working on this, even if the bill passes, on things that help them with the regulatory framework, things to make it easier. The bill has some of that, by the way, on certificate of need, and also with the costs. We don't want to have any Minnesotans served by utility where they're disadvantaged by the bill.
One reason for the bill, cited by its proponents, is climate change. Speaker Melissa Hortman referred to the increase of 100 and 500-year adverse weather events at a recent press conference. But couldn't those same adverse weather events limit the availability of wind or solar or hydroelectricity? In other words, can the grid operate if the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine for extended periods of time?
Sure. Well, I think you're asking two questions. One, can we reasonably expect the wind to keep blowing and the sun to keep shining? The answer is yes, as best we can judge it. And by the way, since I'm not a scientist, I can say this. Those scientists who study climate, and there are two meteorologists in my caucus now, Senator Mitchell and Senator Kupek, point out that in the 70s and 80s, as climate change started to be studied and understood, many of them predicted exactly what we've seen. The temperature increases, the carbon going into the atmosphere. So I think we can rely on them when they say, no, our best guess is the wind's going to keep blowing and the sun's going to keep shining. The second question you ask is, what about the short term when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining? Very exciting developments in storage, battery technology. Just an article in a major metropolitan newspaper that I shall not name this week about some of the progress. If we can store energy for 100 hours, we can do a ton, even with our intermittent sources like wind and solar. I'm very optimistic, and I can't resist a second time. That's exactly the kind of innovation that I think Minnesota is well positioned to take advantage of and really to be a leader in.
Is it fair to say that this bill is trying to take advantage of technology that is maybe not quite there yet, but probably coming down the pike?
Sure, and it's not just technology that's brand new, where people say, wow, I didn't know they could store battery for 100 hours. By the way, we can store now for 3 or 4 hours, but that isn't really functional at a utility scale. But an improvement in some of the existing technologies. Right now, Minnesotans would probably go to sleep if we talked about it, but the improvement in wind turbine efficiency, it's mammoth. It's like 30%. So we are watching wind turbines being retrofitted, if that's the right term, producing a major increase in generation. So it's not just the new things that are coming out that are cool. It's the way we're going to continue to do things. That's also present in hydroelectric power, carbon capture, and a bunch of other cool stuff.
Some may recall the loss of power in Texas in 2021 that was due to a polar vortex event. Many Minnesotans paid higher rates in the aftermath, which highlights the interconnecting web of energy production across the nation. The governor of North Dakota last week threatened to sue the state of Minnesota over some provisions that may or may not be in this bill. What are your thoughts on other states getting involved and their concerns about what we're doing?
Well, first of all, it's a great point. If Minnesotans don't know this, we are interconnected on the MISO grid, so we depend on an energy marketplace that includes other states. That's a good thing. In fact, it relates to your point about wind and solar. The sun may not be shining in North Mankato, but it is definitely shining over a lot of that grid, and so collectively that indemnifies us a little bit against the intermittent nature. The Texas storm was an example of a state underfunding resiliency. This is a little bit geeky, but I have some geek DNA in me. One of the things Minnesota utilities do very well is protect against storms, extreme weather, so that our power doesn't go out, our transmission doesn't suffer. That's a good thing. Texas, a little bit less regulation, a little bit less requirement, and they paid for it, and it affected us here because that affected the spot price in the marketplaces. But to your other question about North Dakota, first of all, I hope Minnesotans are cheering for the success of North Dakota in general. We don't want states cheering against each other. We revisited the North Dakota issue with some people, and we actually made a small change in the language of Senate File 4, which is to say utilities are expected to procure 100% carbon-free energy by generation or to procure it from a carbon-free source. So I'm not trying to mess with anybody's interstate commerce. I'm simply saying we want these utilities to get to that benchmark. And again, those boards are in the best position to do it. One last point on that. If they have an existing contract in 2025 that relies on energy exported from another state, like the great state of North Dakota, those boards are in the best position to say, hey, by 2032, we got to look at this. How does that fit our mix? And that's exactly what we want to have happen. And that's exactly the kind of people we want in charge of that decision.
Now, we only have just a brief amount of time left, but there is language in the bill about a preference for local job creation and a preference for domestically produced technologies. Can you talk about that just briefly?
Just briefly.
Yes.
Well, briefly, I'm a big proponent of local jobs. That means Minnesota workers working on Minnesota projects, and the bill gives a preference for that. It also has a preference for domestic production of the materials. We want that. Let's have Minnesota resources as much as possible go into these projects. And I think I've seen success on those types of provisions in other bills, and I'm positive we'll have success with that on this bill too.
Senator Nick Frentz, thank you.
Thank you, Shannon. Good to see you again.
The House of Representatives has passed, on a party line vote, an energy regulatory framework that includes the goal of 100% carbon-free electricity production by the year 2040. The Senate is poised to take action in the coming days. Senator Andrew Matthews is the ranking minority member of the Senate Energy, Utilities, Environment, and Climate Committee, and he now joins me to offer his perspective. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Opponents of the measure are calling this the blackout bill. What does that mean?
It addresses some of the top concerns with this bill, the reliability and affordability of energy in the state of Minnesota. And the blackout bill is the title given because we're going to take a lot of baseload generation off the grid, out of Minnesota's mix, replace it with a lot of wind and solar and other renewables in the mix. And just from a math standpoint, if we don't have the sufficient baseload that we need, Minnesota will be at a strong risk for blackouts in the future.
Perhaps because the House Republican caucus rejected the bill, I can imagine that the Senate Republican caucus may also reject this bill when it comes on the floor. What is your primary objection to the measure?
Yes, I don't believe there will be much support in the Republican caucus. And this version is very different from previous renewable energy standards that have passed through, like the 2007 bill. When we have done significant changes like this before, there has been a lot of collaboration. There has been a lot of bipartisanship working together, making sure all sides were heard. And the 2007 bill, for an example, got a large bipartisan vote in both the House and the Senate. And they are not doing that this year. They have run it through. It was a party line vote in the House. It probably will be or very close in the Senate. And there's a lot of concerns still being ignored that go to the reliability, that go to affordability, that go to the ability of some of our energy generating organizations, from the utilities like Xcel and Minnesota Power to the smaller co-ops or the small town munis in rural Minnesota. They still have a lot of concerns about what their ability will look like to be able to provide affordable electricity to their small rural town or to their community or their co-op region that they have. And there are still a lot of unanswered questions that are not being addressed with this bill that's being run through at a rapid pace still in the first month of the session.
Last year, now retired Senator David Senjum held hearings on the advancing technology in nuclear energy production. If I remember correctly, you authored a bill last year that would have lifted the moratorium on nuclear power expansion here in Minnesota. In your view, should that be part of the mix?
That absolutely should be part of the mix. We had a nuclear and a climate expert in that committee last year who basically said, if you are serious about climate change but are not going to lift the nuclear moratorium in your state, then you're not really serious. It absolutely needs to be a part of the mix because that will be the strongest remaining completely clean source of energy. Nuclear is strong, reliable, it's always on 24/7, generates basically the same amount of power around the clock. Wind and solar are dependent on the weather. I even looked today before I came here. It's a very cold day today. The sun is shining, but right now for Minnesota and our region, nuclear, coal, and gas are providing 85% of the energy that's powering our electricity right now in real time today. Solar is producing about 1.5% on a sunny winter day. There's just still some problems and issues with how reliable these sources can be. And so if we're going to move to a 100% standard, nuclear absolutely needs to be a part of that mix with the two nuclear plants we have, and we need to look at expanding it.
There's language in the bill that instructs the Public Utilities Commission to prioritize the hiring of workers in areas where facilities are being retired. You represent Becker, where all three coal-fired power plants are scheduled to be decommissioned in the coming years. Do you approve of the goal of ensuring that those workers are prioritized in any new efforts?
Yeah, it's a tough subject for my community. That is better than nothing, is basically the view that I get from my hometown often. I think many people there would prefer to keep that plant there, keep those jobs there. It has sustained a lot of families in the region, and it has provided a lot of energy for most of the state of Minnesota. And unfortunately, decisions have been made to retire these plants and start winding them down. So with that in mind, yes, I do support these programs that are going to help the workers in this interim, but it's basically the last good option out of bad options remaining, in my view.
North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum has threatened a lawsuit against the state of Minnesota over some of the provisions in the bill. What's your perspective on the potential of that lawsuit from a neighboring state over the carbon issues?
I think they have a really good case. Here's why. The underlying bill is going to try to regulate what companies do generating electricity outside of our state boundaries. They want to control their behavior and how they generate outside of Minnesota. And that's unconstitutional under the Dormant Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And I know that gets into legalese and constitutional terminology. But that is a clear violation. A state cannot regulate what someone does in another state. North Dakota already has a history. There was a proposal about 6 to 8 years ago where they sued Minnesota over something similar, a regulation we tried to that would impact what companies did in their state. They sued the state of Minnesota. They won. Minnesota had to pay over $1 million out of taxpayer dollars in the legal fees paying for that suit. The likely path is going to happen again. North Dakota likely will file suit if this gets enacted into law, and they will probably win. And we have brought the concerns to the Democrat majority and to the governor. They've made a small tweak in the language, and they are saying that it covers it, but it really doesn't. North Dakota has affirmed that's not really making a substantive change to the issue. And so I think they have a strong constitutional grounds against Minnesota. We're going to bring that issue up again in the debate. It's fallen on deaf ears so far, but I'm hoping that we get a different response.
Just briefly before we have to go, what kinds of changes would need to be made to the bill in order for it to achieve your support? Or if it were up to you, what would be your approach, but briefly?
Here would be my plan. Obviously, the nuclear moratorium needs to be lifted, and then we need to study how it can best grow in the state of Minnesota. Then we should not be closing our baseload generation in the state until we have something sizable and permanent and reliable enough to replace it with. And then we need to study the rates. They're baked in right now that we're paying a high cost in our rates for renewable energy, even though they only give us intermittent energy dependent on the weather. And then we need to look at the affordability cost. One piece from the 2007 bill that the proponents haven't refuted is that passing that mandate back then did increase the cost on Minnesotans. We're above the national average for electricity costs. We're growing faster than the national average, and I believe we'll continue even faster with this 100% mandate. So all of that needs to be looked at, and that would be my plan.
Senator Andrew Matthews, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week in the Senate, on a vote of 35-32, the Senate approved additional funding to expand the criminal enforcement branch of the Attorney General's office.
When we complete this work today, and this bill moves through the process, and we achieve our funding, the criminal division in the Attorney General's office will have 10 attorneys and 3 legal assistants to be able to do the important work in pursuing justice in partnership with our county attorneys. And that's why I ask for your support.
When I see language that says enhanced criminal enforcement and other related items, initiatives, to me that says this is a blanket appropriation that can be used for almost any purpose the Attorney General decides to do. Folks, the Attorney General is here to enforce the laws of Minnesota. Many of our laws are criminal. We've seen the Attorney General spend more time prosecuting business owners who violated an executive order than he has rioters that ruined the streets of Minneapolis.
People speaking from counties like McLeod County, who obviously would not understand Hennepin County or Minneapolis politics, because Minneapolis is one of the most diverse cities in the state, and McLeod County being, 98% white? 98% white, you can go weeks without seeing a black person in McLeod County. Of course they're not going to understand what's going on. That's number one. Number two, they said, hey, let's support our county attorneys instead. Let's have trust in them. Well, the County Attorneys Association are saying, we support our Attorney General, we need his help. We can't do this on our own.
We shouldn't take this $5 million that's bypassed the normal budgeting process that's coming up here that we're going to be doing the Attorney General's budget in. Let's not do that. Let's run this bill through on its own without limitation. And let's make that happen. I don't know of any Minnesotans, I don't know any constituents in my district that would be happy to do that.
And Senator Jeremy Miller outlined the details of his proposal to legalize sports betting.
Since the United States Supreme Court struck down federal law in 2018 that prohibited sports betting, other states have been moving at a rapid pace to legalize it. Based on my last count, 36 states, along with Washington, D.C., have passed laws to authorize sports betting, including our border states. It is time to authorize sports betting here in Minnesota, and I believe this proposal or something similar can gain the bipartisan support necessary to get it done.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.